Love this podcast? Support this show through the Acast supporter feature. It's up to you how much you give, and there's no regular commitment. Just hit the link in the show description to support now.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
The Big Sister Hotline is recorded on the stolen lands of the Wurundjeri people of the Kulin Nation. Sovereignty of these lands has never been ceded. I pay my respects to elders, past and present. The Hotline is proud to be an ongoing supporter of JIRA, an Aboriginal-controlled community organisation where culture is shared and celebrated. This land always was and always will be Aboriginal, and Black Lives Matter. Big Sister Hotline, how can we help? Hello, dear listeners, guys, gals, and non-binary pals. You're listening to the Big Sister Hotline, a weekly podcast offering frank, funny, and feminist advice on life, love, and whether or not you should break up with your no-good Nick boyfriend. Spoiler, the answer is always yes. You'll be familiar with this week's guest from her many appearances on Australian television, where she has brought her funny, fantastic self to the homes of millions of us every week. She first appeared on Gogglebox. She was then the runner-up in I'm a Celebrity, Get Me Out of Here. She's now hosting a podcast. She is Evie Jones. Evie, welcome.
Thank you. That was a wonderful introduction.
Just made that up right off the top of my head.
Very good. Very good. I'd need to write all that shit down. You've got a good memory. Came runner up. I'm really glad that you popped that in.
Look, second the best. Who remembers winners of anything?
No, exactly. Exactly. The runner up is it. And I've had the career since. Richard hasn't, poor thing.
We were first introduced to you kind of nationwide on Gogglebox, where you're just. I remember watching you, and because obviously you were with one of your best friends, Angie Kent, partnered there, and I remember just thinking that you two were just so charming together. But I think a lot of people wouldn't necessarily be aware that you've had a long career in media prior to that.
Yeah.
You weren't just kind of plucked out of obscurity.
Well, I knew the behind-the-scenes producers and editors of Endemol that when they got told about the new concept show coming, you know, I would often be asked by my friends who worked behind the scenes, you know, you should audition for this. You should go on Big Brother. You should do, you know, we could fast track you through everything. And I would say no to absolutely everything. And I've worked as a publicist and I'd worked as a professional singer, I say, because I got paid. But, you know, and I'd done a lot of acting and things like that. And I was trained in acting. So I definitely had this long career of not really doing successful things, but always there, always behind the scenes. So when Gogglebox came along, I actually only said yes to it because I thought this is going to be a bit of fun finally to get in front of the camera, and it's not going to take off. So it'll be something fun to show my niece and nephews, you know, down the track, their kids, that kind of thing. No idea that it was going to do what it did and what it's still doing, which I'm really glad that it did. And it's only done really positive things for me. But, yeah, so I'd always kind of been around but just in the background like a creep.
Well, it's the perfect concept for a reality television show as well. I mean, I gag for reality TV. I love it. I'm a huge fan of Survivor, not so much Big Brother or, you know, any of the kind of just watch people sit around and do things kind of shows. But there's a difference between loving to watch it and thinking I want to go and spend 50 days on a beach doing challenges that will severely stress me out.
Yeah.
Sitting around TV, I could do that.
Yes. Yeah. But Gogglebox is the best concept ever. And not only is it reality. It's more observational documentary, which makes it very different in the media's eyes, like the and other networks. Like they just, there's a real snobbery with reality TV, obviously. Whereas in Gogglebox, for the first, I think they've won 4 Logies, but the first 2 Logies they won, it was in the factual category. Mm. They weren't even over into the reality, not reality, the entertainment, you know. So we were always quite, wore that with pride, with if people would call us reality people, we'd be like, no, ob doc. Like there's a difference.
One of the great things about, I mean, I know you've probably talked about Gogglebox so many times over the years, but never with me.
Yeah.
One of the great things about Gogglebox, particularly in terms of quote unquote reality TV or obdoc, as you say, is that unlike quote unquote reality television, there's actually a hugely diverse cast of people.
There is. That's the beauty, I think, that someone said, not someone, a lot of people have said that Gogglebox is a visual Twitter, because you've got just so many people tweeting and giving their opinions from everywhere, from every walk. And it's so beautiful because they really have chosen a diverse range of Australia. There really are those families out there and those households, not just families, you know, the couples or singles out there. And it's so lovely to see. And everyone has embraced it so well that it's weird to me that hasn't happened more in, you know, I mean, it slowly is, but I think Gogglebox proves that we're very open and accepting. I would personally, and I've said this to the EP many, many times, would love to see a Muslim family or and Indigenous family. There is a diversity, but I don't think we've gone as diverse as we can go yet.
One of the things that we don't see on Australian television are fat bodies. I mean, we don't really see that on TV in general or in movies in general. And we don't see the bodies of old women, and we definitely don't see the bodies of old fat women.
No.
And especially not when you also add racial diversity as well. One of the things that really resonated very strongly with audiences and you when you were on I'm a Celebrity, Get Me Out of Here, was the speech that you gave about there was a challenge where they wanted you all to collectively weigh in, you know, to stand on a set of scales to see how much weight you'd lost, which, as you correctly pointed out in the show, is a really fucked up thing to do.
Yeah.
Particularly not just if you're someone who, like you and like me, have had, you know, histories of eating disorders and terrible body image, but also for people watching to have that message reiterated to them that this is, that the success here is in how much weight you've lost.
Yeah, let's celebrate it.
And you delivered this really powerful speech about your own experiences with that and why you refused to participate, basically. And, you know, the outpouring of love for you was so strong that once again it makes you question why. I mean, I'm asking rhetorically, I know why we don't have fat bodies on TV, because we live in a fucking fatphobic world.
Yep. I mean, we do, but they're the ones that get picked on or ridiculed. They're the, not the villains, but they can be, yeah, you know. And that's the only reason they're there, is to teach us some kind of a lesson of entertainment or, you know, beware of something.
A cautionary tale.
Yeah, yeah, that's it.
I mean, it could have been, the narrative of that season could have been so different if you were a different kind of person. And it could have then been framed in this really toxic, gross way that, you know, you step on the scales naturally, like being out in the jungle for that long, you know. It's the same thing that happens in shows like Survivor, where they lose a lot of weight at the end, and it's kind of, or the, you know, the worst toxic show ever, The Biggest Loser, where that celebratory kind of, I've gone from being this obviously awful, terrible person who doesn't deserve love and value and respect to someone who has earned all of those things through sheer hard work, blood, sweat and tears, in incredibly unhealthy ways.
An incredibly unhealthy way, and doing damage that could last for decades, physically and mentally and emotionally. The best part of that speech has been what happened a year later when I didn't even know it was Angie who actually sent me a text, and she said, girl, have you noticed the weigh-in's gone? There was no weigh-in this year, in this season. Oh. I went, what? She goes, no, it's gone, and they didn't even mention it. So I looked it up and went, where's the what? And it's gone. No one mentioned it. Our Biggest Loser went before that kind of thing. And that was actually, I'd never used that as one of the catalysts for in my thinking. But when I thought about it afterwards and someone had mentioned The Biggest Loser, I thought, you know what, that's been gone. I think a year or two before that. It just doesn't work anymore. I think Channel 10, the last Biggest Loser they had to put it on late at night to run the season out because it got no ratings. We are changing as women and men, or I think mostly women, because you can see a bigger man on television, no problem. Mm. You know, a beer gut is kind of a rite of passage, really.
Especially if he's funny.
Yeah, exactly.
You know, the sitcom model of the fat guy, skinny wife.
Especially if he's an ex sportsman.
Yeah. Some men in Hollywood do get subject to a much lesser degree, they do get subject to fat shaming, you know, tabloid photographs of them between Marvel movies, whatever. Look at them, you know, the weight that they've piled on, blah, blah, blah. So the fat shaming definitely exists, but men who are fat or even who have less than stereotypically conventionally idealized bodies are able to succeed and progress career-wise, particularly in the media, in a way that fat women or even just women who aren't a size 6 just aren't. Never have a fat woman on The Bachelor.
Yeah, no. Fuck no. Absolutely not. It just is a no-no. You know, not even as one of the women that goes pretty early. They don't even let a fat woman get trotted in and trotted out the way they do with the others.
What were you like when you were a teenager and a young, you know, sort of a young adolescent woman?
I was loud, funny, same, with a lot less wisdom, but thought I knew everything. I was extremely likable, extremely depressed, but hit it all really, really well. Would cry myself to sleep every single night, but because I have bipolar and I'm medicated and treated for it now, but going through my teens, I was two people, like my manic up through the day, an extreme manic low at night. So, living a very double life as a teenager. Like, I think the one thing about depression that a lot of people don't seem to understand is how you can have a mental illness but be a really positive person, like be a really up person. And it's got absolutely nothing to do with your attitude towards life or your personality. My personality is upbeat. It just is. Mm. I always look at the silver lining and I always look at the bright side of life and all that kind of crap. But my depression is extremely dark. My brother doesn't have depression, but he's a pessimist. He was diagnosed by a child psychologist as a pessimist at a very young age. Like they used this amazing, not amazing, this interesting fear, like analogy kind of thing to my parents and said, look, he'll always see the negative in life. As this child psychologist would say, if you said to him, Matthew, we're going to Disneyland tomorrow, and Disneyland's your favorite place in the world, and we're going, his first reaction, natural instinctual reaction would be, yeah, I bet it rains. You know, so there's a definite difference of mental illness, health to personality and nature And I find all that kind of really fascinating. And that is fascinating to me because of my teenage years. My teenage, I was a real dichotomy of fun and complete darkness. But I was one of those kids at school that never belonged in a group. I could float because I got along with everyone.
I relate to all of that very strongly, but substitute depression for anxiety.
Right, yep.
And, you know, particularly the last bit of I wasn't popular in school, but I definitely wasn't popular enough to hang out with the cool kids. But I was kind of bullied sometimes by – I was more bullied by the uncool kids than I was the cool kids because I think it was – offensive to them in some way that I could float around.
Yeah, yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
It's like, well, who the fuck are you? Who are you? You're just like us.
You're just better than us.
Big loser like us. Who do you think you are? But I think that for me, I don't know what your experience was in terms of how many schools you went to, but I went to a lot of schools growing up. You know, my family lived in different parts of the world. Wow. And so I was very used to starting a new school. I hated it. I hated the anxiety of it. Yeah. But I came very used to going into any situation and making myself, you know, be a chameleon in it really. Yeah. Flit through. Be just inoffensive enough that you could kind of move seamlessly through all of those different spaces. Inoffensive, that's not how anyone would describe me these days.
No, I know. You know, and I was the same. I was going to say I was a chameleon because I only went to the one school, but I flitted between the groups as a chameleon. I changed as I needed to, adapted to each group, to each individual person, and to give them what I needed to get back from them in a way of acceptance. But it was funny because I think your anxiety obviously came with so many moves and so much change. My depression was very in the nothing changed for me, everything. And I still to this day absolutely love change. Like I hate stagnant, I hate routine, I hate things being the same all the time. And I think that comes from, you know, growing up in my later childhood, because in my early childhood we lived in a really metropolitan wonderful place and then we moved to the fucking back ass end of nothing. And my brother excelled because it was sport based and I absolutely sank, like just in quicksand, like just constantly being trying to, you know, get my way out of it. But that everyday mundaneness of that no change, I love change so much. But it's funny because, you know, you had so much change and anxiety and I had so much mundaneness with depression. It's really interesting to me.
Well, interestingly, I have done a lot of work on myself and my, you know, exploring my the roots of anxiety, etc. I was actually chatting with a friend last week about how she's a friend as well, but she's my acupuncturist. And she was saying that she thinks that I should try somatic-based therapy, which is my understanding is that it's more about like a bodily response or exploring like where the anxiety is in the body and trying to work through it that way. Because the thing is I can sit there and analyze. I've analyzed my anxiety and its roots to death and I know exactly where it comes from. It's not so much that I experienced a lot of change growing up. A lot of it is based in attachment theory.
Yeah.
You know, the youngest of three children, I had an extremely depressed mother, had a very absent father in lots of ways because he was working all the time. And I just, no love has ever felt secure.
Yeah.
So a lot of it is based in like the small child inside. You can know all of that stuff. And go, right, but how I can't, there's no point in me going and sitting and doing talk therapy because I can explain to the psychologist exactly what's going on. And you always know exactly what to say back to them. So it just becomes this sort of meaningless exchange.
Mm-hmm.
When were you diagnosed with bipolar?
17, I think. That's when it was first really flagged, not I don't think they diagnosed me then. There was a very, we don't want to, you know, go too hard on that kind of thing. It wasn't until I had massive manic problems, episodes in my late 20s, that it was became a really, definite diagnosis and treatment plan and that kind of stuff.
Were you scared with that diagnosis? I'm just thinking that in terms of, you know, this would have been 30 years ago.
Yeah, it was 30 years ago. Yeah, this year, 30 years ago. The flagging, no, I was never scared. I was always relieved to know.
I just want to clarify that I only asked about being scared because I remember, I think that the conversations that we have publicly about mental health have progressed so much in the last 2 decades or 10 years even, where one of the things that really propelled my anxiety when I was a teenager was I was terrified of being mentally unwell. I was clearly extremely mentally unwell, and I was terrified of what that meant because the only representations I had of it came from movies where at the time, you know, we weren't even saying the word bipolar then. We were talking about manic depressives. The representation of bipolar especially was it wasn't positive. It didn't paint a picture of manageability at all. And the stigma around mental illness at the time when we were both young was still, and it's huge now, but it was so much bigger.
Yeah, no, I totally agree. But, you know, that's just really reminded, I think I had never really thought about this, but it was never said as bipolar back then. It was always told to me it was manic depression. And I actually don't think, because we didn't have the internet back then, that I really knew what manic depression was. I was just like, okay, that's great. Can we fix this? Or is this, you know, is it, you know, treatable? But yeah, bipolar, I didn't put bipolar and manic depression, really put it together until my manic, you know, episodes. And then it's almost like I remember watching a movie where someone got told they had tumors and then they mentioned cancer and they were like, what? What do you mean? I've got cancer as well? And they're like, what do you think the tumors are?
That's Muriel's Wedding.
That's it. Yes. That's it. Fuck. So good. I think there was another movie, you know, Joseph Gordon-Levitt.
Oh yeah. Was it 2020 or something? The one.
It was another. We got 2020 on the brain. Cancer. But yeah, it happened. I think something very similar in that, like, just like, what? A tumor is cancer. I think bipolar and manic depression for me was kind of the same thing. People would use them and I wouldn't really, understand exactly what they meant. And I certainly wasn't going and, you know, doing all the research I needed to do back then.
How would you have done? You
know? That's right. We had a big thing of encyclopedias, Britannica, but I fucking wasn't going through that thing, that's for sure. I was just happy to have the label because the label meant I could tell people something. When they said, what's wrong with you? What's wrong with you? I'd be like, manic depression. They're like, oh, I don't know. And I'm like, me neither. So let's just drink.
But well, actually, one of our questions today from Little Sisters is specifically about this. And I didn't actually realize coming into this that you had bipolar. So this has worked out so fortuitously. Look at us, both of us looking at the silver lining, optimistic people.
Yes.
Shall we get to the question?
Yes, please.
Please note my disclaimer in very big flashing lights that neither I nor Evie Jones are doctors, counselors, or professionally trained sex therapists. We're just two women on the internet who live with mental illness and do it very fucking well.
Amen.
High Functioning Depressive says, so often I get told that I simply cannot be depressed because I function well, excel even. As a mother, full-time worker, law student, and woman, I absolutely struggle with the demand on my time, energy, and mental health. I recently decided to take part in a clinical trial for treatment-resistant depression, and I have had mixed reactions from people in my life. It's as if certain people don't think my depression is bad enough to warrant a treatment that is not mainstream. The trial is working. I feel what I assume to be what, quote-unquote, normal people feel like. I feel well for the first time in my adult and even teenage life. For the first time, I don't look at a busy road and think, I could jump into that and it would be over. My question is, why is it that I feel guilty for feeling well? For having the ability to say, no, I'm not going to do X, Y, Z because it doesn't serve me and I simply don't want to. This is something new for me. I'm a people pleaser at heart, but I note that this also leads to burnout and I finally have the strength with this treatment to say no. The reactions to this newfound backbone have been swift and interesting. Friends that I thought were supportive have left me behind because I'm no longer there, if that makes sense. I guess I put myself first now rather than everyone else to my detriment. Am I wrong for changing the order of things? And am I wrong for seeking something outside of the box for my depression? Evie.
Well, I think she's answered her own question in there when she said she's a people pleaser and always has been. And what was the bit where she said she feels guilty for, you know, being
feeling well?
She's just not used to it. This is just something that hasn't, she's not used to. So I think the answer is right in there with the question that she's just got to get used to her new normal. And the guilt, I think, comes with a matter of things. You know, we as women are made to feel guilty about our existence all the time. But also, I think that guilt comes from compassion and empathy, you know, as well. It's like, am I being selfish? And then you have to question, is selfish a bad thing? Like, you know, understanding the difference between being selfish and self-centered really helps, I think. Being selfish is so extremely important, and being self-centered can be so, you know, distracting. I think when she's gets better at being who she is now, she's going to lose a lot of friends, and that's a wonderful thing. I absolutely loved the first time I put out something quite controversial on my Instagram. I loved how many people I lost. I was like, oh, this is so easy. I've just culled a lot of racists here. And like, I put out a thing about Australia Day. It was years ago. And on the Angie and Evie page, and she was like, oh, are you sure you want to do that? I was like, oh, I'm not going to do it if you don't want me to do it. And she goes, no, fuck it, do it. Go for it. And we got rid of so many, I mean, we got absolutely abused, but it was such a lovely way to find out people's true colors. And I think this goes for this beautiful woman as well. She now realizes, can see exactly who's there for the right reasons. If they're dropping off like flies, let them go away.
I think that the first thing that I want to say to her as well is congratulations. Congratulations for trying something new that you obviously went into with a lot of hope and optimism, and that is working for you.
To
experience anything that alleviates the symptoms of mental illness, whether or not it's depression or whether or not it's anxiety or an amazing combination of the two, to seek treatment for that as a first, you know, as the first thing that we should say is amazing, because a lot of people don't do that, and they don't do it for a variety of reasons, and the reasons that men don't do it are very different from the reasons that women don't do it. Speaking generally, oftentimes men don't do it because patriarchy has made them fear reaching out, because that somehow makes them less of a man in patriarchy's eyes. And one of the reasons why women don't do it is because we're conditioned to not put ourselves first, and conditioned to assume that our problems are the last on the list, particularly if we're mothers as well. I mean, I'm assuming it's the same for people who are partnered with men. I don't know. I'm not, and I don't care about men. So that's not true. That's a joke.
Kill all men, I think.
But you know, I relate to the bit about, we talked about this a little bit before we went to the questions, the idea of being a high functioning person with, or maybe that language is problematic, being someone who has mental illness and has developed a raft of strategies to be able to cover it up more effectively than maybe other people have because of temperament or probably even because of what underpins the anxiety. Like for me, when she said that she is a people pleaser, instant recognition. Weirdly, people would not expect this of me at all, but a lot of my anxiety is related to being a people pleaser, to not letting people down, to being there for people, to giving. And then I end up, I make all of these commitments because I'm too scared to say no. I'm too scared to say, I'm sorry, I can't do that. Or I don't have capacity for that right now. Or I just don't have time, or I just don't want to. For me, when I hear the term high functioning anxious person or high functioning depressive person, it's like she's describing me.
Yeah. So I think high functioning is good. Like you look at a high functioning alcoholic or drug addict, these are people who have problems but are getting through their life seemingly normal. So she's a high functioning.
I suppose the problem with the, just to interrupt you quickly, the problem I feel with the term high functioning is that, you know, I don't want to kind of create like a dichotomy between high functioning people. That's great. You're like getting through and you're doing it really well, and low functioning, like, well, why aren't you functioning better? You know, it's because it's all so individual, isn't
it? Yeah. I think high functioning is just such it really is an external shell that we, you know, step into. You are, and it's not, good, high functioning and low functioning to me is not necessarily one is good and one is bad. It's just the shell that you're in. And there is so much individuality behind those inside those shells.
And sometimes what it can mean is that you're just really, really good at
hiding it. Yeah. That's what I think it is. That's why I don't think to say someone's a high functioning anything is a positive, because it just means you're hiding the shit that's going on. And you're doing it well.
It was interesting the bit that she said about feeling guilty for feeling better as well, because I, again, relate to that too. You know, any of the treatments, it's almost like at the age of 39, I've become so used to being accompanied everywhere I go by this sort of anxious companion who lives inside me, that there is a fear of what it means to let go of it. Like, because sometimes anxiety has served me well, you know, the anxiety that I feel about deadlines pushing me, propelling me forward to succeed and to achieve has been beneficial to me. If I get rid of that, do I become an entirely different person? Yeah. Do I lose the edge that I think can make me, you know, effective in what I do? And also, when you're so used to having that feeling of anxiety, as horrible as it is, I talked about this in the episode with Pandora Sykes a few weeks ago. I've started taking CBD oil and I really like it. It just takes the edge off of the anxiety in a way that doesn't, you know, alter my brain chemistry in any way, which is fine for people who enjoy that. That's cool, but it's just doesn't work for me. So I feel really comfortable taking it, and I often feel really, really good. And my experience of thinking about things that formally, like when I'm not on CBD oil, thinking about things that make me anxious, or that, you know, like these deep existential dreads that I wake up with at 4 a.m. And that seem so impossible to surmount, that, you know, the terrible, you sort of fall into that terrible black hole of thinking. I can think about those things when I've taken the CBD oil, and they just don't seem as profoundly terrifying.
Yeah.
It's like, I feel like I can cope with that. And it's a really interesting feeling, because I've never really had that in my life. But what I've found interesting about it as well is that there's a part of me that thinks, am I allowed to feel this all the time?
Yeah.
Like, should I ration the feeling?
Oh yeah.
Because maybe it's not okay for me to feel okay all of the time. Yeah. Why, how can that be allowed?
Yeah. I think that goes back to Adam and Eve, doesn't it? Like, we're always like, are we sinning? Is this good feeling allowed? Like, are we going to be punished for being happy? Also, when I think you're just, there's so much weight in conditioning. There's, you know, when you're used to functioning a certain way, any kind of change to that, you're going to question, which is inevitably going to bring guilt about it. And that's where, you know, we're lucky enough to be evolved species that can question and then get the answers to those kind of things and say, yeah, it's okay to feel a bit guilty. This is why you feel guilty, and this is how, you know, you move past that kind of thing. I think, yeah, it's just a human condition that we just feel guilty for, I think, just change. And if, especially if the change seems to only be affecting us in a positive way. If people around you are not supportive of you becoming a happy person, oh, my God, that is heartbreaking to me. Like, absolutely, you are just going to lose so many awful people from your life without ever realizing at the time, like before now, that, you know, these people were awful. Like, the fuck? Oh, that pisses me off, that to think that any friend of mine would, number one, say, oh, I don't know if you should be doing a clinical trial that's not mainstream. To number two, saying, oh, you know, you're just not there for me anymore. And I'm just going to, you know, go slink back into the background. And yeah, it's a funny thing, change. I think she'll adapt well. She's gone for this clinical trial, which means she really wants to be happier. And what comes with this is a lot of people not being comfortable with that. So she'll get through it. I think, you know, just keep working through it. You'll get there. And you know, in these kind of trials, you end up, you know, on forums and meeting different people and, you know, start looking at different things on the internet, and a whole new world's going to open up for this person, which is going to be so exciting for her because she's going to really become so educated about so many things that that's just something to look forward to, and leave her husband if she's married.
Definitely want to leave your husband, but we know that that's true. Maybe you're very happy with him. I don't know. The last thing I'll just say on this before we go on to the next question is that, and this is for anyone listening who either is currently seeking treatment for mental health or would like to seek treatment to improve their mental health, is that it's a very personal experience, and only you can know what it feels like to live inside your head, however you present to the rest of the world, whether or not that's as someone whose mental illness is not as perceptible to people or someone who is, you know, maybe a little bit more obvious about it. That doesn't really matter, because that's all just a veneer. The only person who knows what's going on inside your head and the distress or happiness you may be feeling is you. And if you would like to feel better inside your head, then you do what you need to do and you find a treatment plan that works,
right,
whatever that may be, regardless of what the people in your life think about it. Well, and you know, go forth and be happy.
Yeah, trust yourself. Trust yourself.
What if, asks, I was casually sleeping with a guy for a bit. When we were both seeing other people, we'd stop sleeping with each other. When things didn't work out with the other person, we'd sleep with each other again. Eventually we stopped. However, we remained friends. The friendship isn't a strong bestie bond. It's more subtle. It's always small talk. For example, how have you been? What's new? How's training going? We've never hung out one-on-one. Contact has only been via message or when we bump into each other at the gym. In saying this, we do care for each other, which is shown by our actions and interpreting messages. The thing is, I keep wondering, what if? I sometimes conclude to myself that things won't go any further than friendship because, as stated before, our conversations are always short and sweet. It's here and there. At one point just recently, I was talking to a different guy, and when I was having a catch-up talk with this friend, I told him, and he said he didn't want to know that I was talking to a guy, and he said he felt weird about it. I was confused because in the early days he had no problems with information like that. I apologized. He apologized back. Things didn't work out with the guy I was talking to. So the question is, why do I keep asking myself what if with my friend?
Because you're bored. You've got nothing else. Just, well, as Maria Kondo would say, does this friendship spark joy in you? You know what? We have not got enough time in this world to hang out with people who you have to interpret a text with, and you have, as she said, just surface conversation. How's your day? What have you been up to? Boring. You know, that's what you have with your barista. And you can have a lot more, you know, but don't, no, you're not meant to be. If he wanted to be with you, he'd be pushing a lot harder, and so would you. You know, if you're both real.
Yeah, that's the thing. People say if it's not a hell yes, then it's a hell no.
Yeah, I think there's also some sometimes you can get to that hell yeah by having an amazing friendship with someone that, you know, you could be friends for 10 years with someone and then kind of go, oh, hell yeah. A slow burn, as they call those, but they're not even having an amazing friendship.
I wonder reading this, I mean, I have a lot of sympathy for this little sister because I have similarly been in situations with men where, you know, as I'm sure you've had this experience, as I'm sure you've had this experience too, Evie, when you start seeing a guy, you start sleeping with him, even if it's very, very casual, as in this circumstance, obviously it is, and initially you're kind of like, whatever. Cool, you know, like this guy's just on the background. He's one of the pots on the back burners until this pot that I'm kind of cultivating on the front burner really starts to fire.
Mm-hmm.
But the problem with the back burner pots is that if they're always simmering away, it's very hard to sleep with someone for an extended period of time on and off and not develop some kind of feelings, whether or not they're true feelings, whether or not they really are authentically intimate romantic feelings, just by way of proximity and repetition, it's hard not to develop some kind of feeling for that person. So it seems to me like there is one of two things going on here. Either she's developed stronger feelings than she is admitting to us or is prepared to even admit to herself, and there's been a shift in the reason that they don't have more intimate conversations than the small talk, how have you been, is because she's gone from being kind of very casual and dismissive about it to being almost so tentative and afraid of disrupting the intimacy that they do have that she's afraid to ask real questions. She's afraid to establish a real relationship with this person because she doesn't want to scare him off. And I'm just suggesting that as a possibility because I've absolutely been in that situation before. The other thing could be that she is that intimacy is just confusing now, that she's really not very interested in him, but that nor can they just be friends because they've slept together a number of times and they've never had an honest conversation, obviously, about what's going on between them. So I guess my advice would be, I think that your advice is great too, like don't sell yourself short. Don't settle for anything less than what you want. But this little sister needs to sit down and really figure out what her feelings are for this person.
Exactly.
Does she want to be with him? Does she not want to be with him? But whatever the answer to that question is, it's time now for you to actually have a real conversation with this person.
Yeah.
Even if you just want to keep sleeping with him while you're waiting for someone else to come along, surely like you can ramp it up now to the next level where you're like, let's honestly discuss what's happening and we can still sleep together and we can still look for other partners, but let's just like open that door on this connection as well.
Yeah, both of those scenarios, they were the two going through my head as well. She just needs to ask him. You know, and not be afraid to ask the questions. They seem like the tough questions. They're not. They're just questions. When he says something like, oh, that really weirds me out when you talk about, don't talk to me about a guy, you know, just a simple question. Oh, does it? Why is that? Do you have feelings what are you for me? Ooh, yeah. You like me. You know, be silly about it, but ask the questions. I think there's a definite, I'd like to know the age of this person because this is me in my 20s and me in my 40s are the two different. Like, am I in my 40s just bored and going, you know, maybe is this the guy? Is this? Or me in my 20s kind of going, I really like him, but I want to act really cool about it and I don't want to freak him out by scaring him away and asking, you know, the questions that I really want the answers to. who knows? We don't know which one she is. She does, though. So, yeah, she needs to sit down and have a really good chat and say, just fucking ask him. Ask him. Have a chat with herself, I mean.
This is something that I wish that I'm working on it now at the very – I wish I'd been better at it when I was in my 20s, but you know, never too late. But this is something that I'm working on is that how to – why is it so scary to just lay out what we want? Why is it so scary to say this situation doesn't actually work for me, or you're not treating me with respect, or you're not – like the more we get to like someone. I regret thinking of all the situations where I look back on how I was at the beginning of something, where I was so cool and so interesting and so funny and very like hard to get, not in a deliberate way, just because I had a life and I was like, well, this person's here and they're fine and, you know, whatever. But then that shift happened, that switch happened where you're like, oh, I actually really like them. And so now I'm going to become a shell of the person that I was because I'm like a deer caught in the headlights of this attraction. And I worry that if I move too quickly that I'm going to be run over.
Yeah, or scare them off. It's such an awful – and you see it in mainstream media all the time on movies and TV shows where the girl will go, so where are we right now? What is this? And it's like, oh, Jesus, here we go, God, you know. We're so shamed to ask those kind of like, what are you thinking? You know, how many scenes have you seen where a girl goes, what are you thinking? And a guy goes, oh, Jesus, I was just thinking about football. What's with you and all the questions? Why do you complicate everything? You know, we get so shamed. Hmm?
It's that, women are framed as being so intense. You're right. We get so shamed for wanting to have any kind of depth.
Yes. And other girls will say to girls, be cool. God, don't be a nag. Don't be a psycho. Don't be a fatal attraction.
Yeah, don't be a money boiler.
Exactly. How dare you ask those kind of questions of a man?
Yeah. Yeah. And the skittishness, you know, I think as well that it all kind of ties back into this, the way that firstly, women are presented with and sold this bullshit projection for their life where they need to find a man and settle down and have babies, get married, definitely get married. And this is the path to happiness. This is what will make us happy. This is what will make our lives worthwhile. Yes. And this is the ultimate goal that we must strive for.
Yes. And you will live happily ever after.
That's what we're presented with. Live happily ever after, as fake and false as that is.
Yeah.
And then the great kind of like bait and switch is we're told to do that, and then everything we do that might lead to establishing a connection with someone is framed as crazy, intense.
Yep.
Like, why are you asking me all these questions? Stop trying to trap me. Stop trying to get me under the thumb. Yep. She's trying to land her man. Why do you want to know what I'm thinking? Yep. Can't we just date casually? So, of course, like it's just another strategy to – make women feel completely destabilized in the world that we live in so that we never actually assert our own needs or wants.
Yeah, it's quite clever, really, because it's worked. It's worked really, really fucking well.
The worst thing that can happen is that they say, oh, I don't want that. And so we have to deal with the heartbreak of that, and then we move on to someone who maybe can provide us for a short or a long-term time with the things that will make us happy and that will value and respect us as humans. But the alternative that too many of us, myself included, always reach for is, well, I won't tell him what I want because then I just fear that he'll run away. So I will just deal with like a scrap of what I want. I'll endure the crumbs at the foot of the table because they taste pretty good.
Yeah, and that's all I deserve. And we're conditioned from such a young, young age that you don't deserve more. I mean, heartbreaking how many times I see someone on a comment say, oh, God, what makes a woman do that? And how often I just want to reply, because she has no self-worth, because she's never, ever been told she's worthy. You know, all her life she's been, you know, and it's not even in an abusive primary kind of focused way. It's this subliminal, you're not worth enough. You're not enough. to be worth, you know, but and then we get to this point where it hits you when you're about your early 30s, really, where you start questioning it, and then you start going, oh, fuck, and you have to re-educate, reprogram, do all this work that so many of us have done or are doing, are still doing, or will be doing till the day we die. It's really quite sad how much work we do. Either way, work to get them, work to understand not getting them, work to
be okay with being by ourselves.
Yeah. Yeah, all of it. And just the deep-seated conditioning of the patriarch that's, you know, the world we live in. So.
Yeah.
Just give up on men completely, I say. Thank you, and thanks for coming to my TED Talk. That music is too good.
Okay, last question for the hour. I have a question about pubic hair. As someone who grew up with parents who very openly discussed sex, bodies, and puberty, I was always aware of their views that pubes are normal, and if anything, they struggled to understand the appeal of removing pubic hair. Moving into adolescence and watching porn and realizing that removing pubes was really common in my age group, I had issues with reconciling this particular issue. We know that it is totally wrong and inappropriate to have sex with children, and yet in order to be fuckable in the eyes of many men, especially those who do not challenge stringent gender ideals, women need to look childlike, big eyes, small bodies, and hairless. Now at 17, I choose to grow my pubes out most of the time, as well as my armpits, shaving my legs the most out of any body part. And I like having this kind of choice. The boy that I am dating actually encouraged me to stop shaving body hair all of the time, given that we both find that it looks sexier to have hair and that really just being comfortable in your own skin is the most attractive physical quality in a person. However, I still ponder over how body hair on women is entwined with politics and how choosing not to remove it still has connotations of dirtiness and quote unquote feminazi crap. Please discuss.
This is a great one for me. So personally, I have body hair and find the world so weird that, you know, parts of it refuse to allow women, socially accepting, refuses to allow women to have body hair, and that somehow you're a dirty feminist. I argue with my girlfriends all the time about it, like, that, because it's a source of humor for my friends. They see my hairy legs and go, oh. Like, it's my hair. Why is that funny? Armpit hair, pubes especially. God, I absolutely can't stand getting rid of my pubes. Just on a health level, the ingrowns, the itch, the way the urine sprays everywhere. Really interestingly, the last guy I was seeing was a lot younger than me and had grown up only on the new porn. So for him, it was a deal breaker. So I got rid of him by not shaving. It was just this lovely little protest that I did without having to say anything. It was just like, there you go. And he's like, oh, and I was like, yeah, you better go. If you can't deal with that, then fuck off. But if you want to shave your hair, shave your hair. Because sometimes I do. I just to see what it looks like, or, you know, how it feels, to have a really deep clean of my skin, like get rid of hairs on my arms, everywhere, just and really give myself a good exfoliating. You know, each to their own. As far as the porn goes, yeah, there's a really disturbing aspect of no hair on women that does make it look like you want to have sex with a child. But I think it's more than that. It's this clean, fresh look that it's a trend. You know, my friend honestly argued with me and said, the bush will never come back. I said, oh, it'll come back. It'll come back. And she goes, no, never. Like, everyone's lasering now. And I'm like, no, it'll come back. This was probably 15 years ago. And the bush is coming back now. Like, you look at certain porn and it's back.
The reason that the bush is coming back is not just because people are becoming increasingly less interested in lasering and plucking and waxing and stuff. But this is exactly how patriarchal beauty standards work, is that they set a goal and people move towards that goal.
Yeah.
And then all of a sudden they shift the goalposts. So it makes total sense, of course, that 20 years ago when Sex and the City was first kind of really popularized in pop culture, the Brazilian, that became this new norm that everyone would kind of make their vaginas look like plucked chickens. I should say vulvas. Everyone would make their vulvas look like plucked chickens. And, of course, now that that's happened and people have established that, they're like, that's gross. We want some hair back on those bushes, please, ladies. Thank you, thank you. Yep, not you. Now, I have to say that I dispute I think it's simplistic to suggest, and I hear this argument from so many people, but I think it's simplistic to suggest that hairless pussies are pedophilic in desire.
I agree.
I actually don't think, because, you know, if you're also looking at the porn model, a lot of those women have really big boobs. Mm-hmm. You know, it's not so much about making women seem childlike. It's about making them seem inhuman.
Yeah,
it's about completely sanitizing every part of a woman's bodies. So you know, boobs have to be really pneumatic in size, and pussies have to be totally hairless.
Well, who do they look exactly like? The Barbie doll. The Barbie doll never had pubic hair, but always had big tits.
I think it's a disgust for the real visceral nature of bodies.
Yep.
You know, and part of what, where it comes from, or part of how it maintains its primacy, is that men in particular are really encouraged to be disconnected from their sexual beings, from their selves as sexual beings, which is not to say that they're discouraged from having sex. Of course they're discouraged. Of course they're encouraged to go out and fuck everything that moves and to like be a red-blooded Aussie man, you know, speaking particularly in an Australian context. But that's very different to having an actual connection with your sexual desire and your sexual self. Yeah. Because to have a connection means to, you cannot look at the body as a site of disgust in the way that patriarchy looks at women's bodies as places of disgust if you are truly connected to your own desire.
Yeah. Yeah, no, I agree. I've got girlfriends who have husbands and they're like, oh, you know, I feel disgusting when I've got hairy legs and everything and he still wants to have sex with me. I'm like, what does he say? And they're like, he's like, I love every single inch of you. Like, I couldn't give a shit how hairy you are or anything. I want to have sex with you. You've turned me on. I don't care about the smell that you think is awful or the hair that you think is awful. But it's funny how many of those same friends will say to me, oh, when I want sex, he knows because I've shaved my legs.
Mm.
And I'm like, God, we've got such a long way to go. You know, I remember going into my dad's porn stash, which you would call a small mountain. He actually had a in the garage, a cupboard, one of those old wooden, you know, that really smelly cupboards that smell of wood and paper. Oh God, that smell is just etched in my brain. But the entire small cupboard, it was like a small boy, filled with Playboys and Penthouse. So he bought them every month. He bought them. And I used to just rifle through them because I just found them so interesting and beautiful, and they were always women with real bodies, like not that I had anything to compare it to, but that's my memory of a really beautiful sexual woman. And I remember even knowing the difference between Penthouse and Playboy, you know, the opening of the vulva in Penthouse to the Playboy, which was just always, you know, over the shoulder and a bit of bush. You know, there's such the difference of, they used to take these amazingly beautiful photographs of women. And then we evolved to really smutty porn that freaks me out completely. And I have girlfriends who now have teenage boys and have to have these really interesting conversations of how that, what they're watching is not normal at all.
It's not real. It's fantasy. It's a very specific kind of fantasy.
And it's disturbing. And she, one of my friends, she has two teenage boys, but she works in an RSL. So she works with younger adults. And there was an 18-year-old girl she worked with who was telling her she hooked up with a guy at the pub and he did the sexy choke on her. And my friend said, wait, hang on, what? The what? The sexy choke. And she goes, you know, when they choke you to make you come. And she goes, what? She goes, yeah, oh, the porn, you know. And she goes, did you want him to do that? And she goes, no, I really didn't like it because I couldn't breathe. And she said, did you say anything to him? And she said, I did. I said, do you like doing that to me? Like, is that turning you on? And he said, oh, no, not at all. But that's what girls like, isn't it? That's what the porn, you know, there's so much fucked up shit now going on that, you know, this is the same girl that said that she has to have a completely naked body to be hot or desired by said guy. I had a boyfriend years ago that I used to shave for all the time without ever asking him. One day when I thought he was cheating on me, I went through his phone. And I found nothing, you know, incriminating. But what I did find was his porn history. And it was literally hairy pussy. That's what he was Googling. And I was like, oh, I wish you told me because I really fucking hate shaving. But isn't it interesting, Clem, how much we need to communicate and we don't communicate?
That would have been so easily solved. Yep. But you two, and also yep. by people doing this in general, sitting down and saying, what do you like?
Yeah.
What turns you on? This is why one of the things that I say to young women in particular now, and actually for all women, I think should do this if you are planning on or would like to date cis men, is to ask them, what kind of porn do you watch? Let's talk about the porn that you watch. Let's talk about the things that you've learned from porn. It's great that you make that point about the guy saying, I don't really like choking you. That's what I've seen. So I thought that that's what you like. Because I hear a lot of stories about women being choked by men where they didn't consent to being choked.
Yeah.
And a lot of them are that those men enjoy choking them and enjoy hurting them.
Yes.
But some of the ones I've heard have been from, you know, women who say that when they've called the guy out on it, they've had a similar response. Oh, I just thought that that's what.
Yeah.
Sex was.
Yeah. And not just from the porn they're watching, from their mates saying, oh, and I choked her. She fucking loved it.
Yeah. Or, you know, well, it's the second time we've had sex, so of course now I'm going to fuck her up the ass.
Yes.
You know? And yes. I'm not going to do it properly. I'm not going to do it, you know, with any kind of care or preparation because porn definitely doesn't show me that.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, just the lack of communication, and again, comes back to that thing of being connected to your desires versus performing sex. You know, you can have this, you can fuck 1,000 people and have a completely non-intimate experience of what that sex should feel like. Or you could have sex with one person and it could be really, really fucking good because you talk, you think about what pleasure is for both of you and you explore that together.
Yeah. Yeah. God, fuck yeah. Is it,
which I'd say is all this. This young woman as well, I'd say that it's great that I'm a little red flaggy about how her boyfriend told her to stop shaving because he likes it.
Mm.
I mean, that's fine. Like if you also like it, that's great.
Yes.
But don't do things just because men like it. Don't let them talk you into doing things you don't necessarily want to do because they find it sexy. I mean, sometimes we do those things, but just don't let that be like the positive feminist trait that, well, he really likes body hair, so I grew it out. Like do it for you. Yeah. Shave, don't, whatever it is, whatever it might be, make sure that you're the one who is in control of that decision.
Yes.
But I think it does seem great that they have a means of talking to each other about what they like, which is great.
Yeah. Yeah, I love it. 17. Fucking new generation, go.
Yeah.
Change our world, please.
grow your hair, don't grow your hair. Yeah, the bush will be back, then the bush will go again. It's all cyclical.
Also, can I just point out the really sad thing about the old laser? This is all happening to my friends. You know how it only works on the dark hairs?
Yeah.
The greys come through anyway. So my friends who are in their late 40s, early 50s, have just got grey hairs coming through that have absolutely mortifying them.
Jen Kirkman has a good spot on that where, you know, the comedian Jen Kirkman, where she talks about her grey pubes coming through and it being like, you know, she was like, white pubes would be fine. That's silky. I'd stroke that like a beard and give out advice, you know, just stroke my pubic hair and just tell people what to do with their lives. But grey hairs, that's like barbed wire. That is a sign that says do not enter. That is the house on the street that the kids don't go trick-or-treating to.
It's a scary, scary witch house. Yeah, oh, fuck. We can't win either way.
No, do what makes you feel good and just be assured that whatever makes you feel good, patriarchy will hate anyway, but one day it will be back.
You've been listening to the Big Sister Hotline, a weekly advice podcast that delivers no-nonsense words with love from the kind of people you know have your back, your big sisters. You can find us on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Podchaser, Google Podcasts, and everywhere else you look for great content, and you can also listen to all the back episodes. If you do like the show, then please consider rating and reviewing it because it's really nice to have the feedback, and it also helps to put the show into the paths of other listeners. If you enjoy the hotline, you can support the ongoing making of it at my Patreon, which is www.patreon.com/ClementineFord, where pledges of more than $10 per month receive access to a bonus monthly episode of The Hotline, only available for download to subscribers. If you have a question you'd like answered, you can submit it to bigsisterhotline@gmail.com. And don't worry, all submissions are treated as totally anonymous. We're big sisters and we've got your back. My guest this week has been the fabulous, fantastic, very, very funny Evie Jones. And Evie, you are doing your own podcast currently as well, Chick Story. Tell me quickly about that and how people can listen.
It's on iTunes and Spotify. It's called Chick Story, as in Chicks in History. And it's basically my friend Annie Potatoes and I talking every week about a woman that isn't in the history books, because I realized very young that all the history books were written by men about men. And I always wondered where the women were in these books. So when I started looking, I found it really, really difficult to find, but there is a lot of information out there, a lot of work, which is, you know, not really me. I'm not a worker, but I'll do the work for this because it's fascinating. Next, we're finishing this season soon. We're up to, I think, only about 20 episodes for this year. Next year, we're going to come back with a second season and we're going to start having guests on. I would like to formally invite you, Clementine Ford, to be one of our chickstorians that comes on and tells us your own interesting story about a chick in history, someone that you knew or don't or didn't. We're going to have different people on every week telling us something.
Yeah, I would be absolutely thrilled to come and be a chickstorian. Thank you very much for asking me, and I'll hold you to that invitation too.
I'll hold you. I'm holding you now.
Evie, thank you so much for being on the show. I love you. I think you're great and funny, and I'm really glad that you're in the world. Remember, there's no topic too thorny and no question too weird for the Big Sister Hotline. We're here for all the questions you don't want to ask your therapist, especially now that it has to be over Zoom. So contact us instead, the Big Sister Hotline. The phone lines are open.
Thank you.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.